I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast, episode 2 with Tim Sylvie and myself, Harry Benjamin. In this episode, we chat to Kelvin Fletcher, an Emmerdale legend, but also racing driver. He chats all about spinning the acting world with the racing world, racing around the country in British GT, whilst also working on film and TV projects and bearing all on primetime ITV. We hope you enjoy and don't forget to like and subscribe. Just search for the Motormouth podcast on your favourite podcast platform, where you can also leave us a review.
So welcome to Motormouth podcast episode number 2. How you been, Harry? What's been happening?
I've been all right. Yeah, no, it's so nice to be on the second one. What have I been doing? I've been doing my Hits radio show, which is
getting up at silly o'clock in
getting
the morning.
Up at silly o'clock in the morning, doing some overnight shifts, which is tough, but it's good fun. Playing all the biggest hits and biggest throwbacks. Hits radio, gonna tune into that one. What have you been up to?
Not much. I mean, what's happened since we last saw each other? Monaco Grand Prix, obviously.
Yeah,
caught up
stuff.
With that. I went go-karting, which I'm awful at, but I have to do a shout out to my brother-in-law Adam, who is incredible. So anyone looking for a driver out there, British touring cars, tin tops, whatever, don't care, he is a serious talent. He won by over a minute.
Wow.
At Daytona and Milton Keynes. So quick shout out
if that
to
doesn't
Adam.
Deserve
well
a test, I don't know what doesn't.
I know, exactly. Now listen, we'll get on with the show. We've got a very special guest with us today. You'll probably know him best from his Emmerdale days, where he was 20 years as Emmerdale's Andy Sugden. And most latterly has turned into a racing driver. So welcome very much, Mr. Kelvin Fletcher. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks, guys.
Good.
What a great intro that was, huh? Thank you.
Pleasure.
Listen, before we get started, and I know you're going to be excited, just like our last guest, Callum, was, I've got you a present.
All right, okay.
And I've brought two...
Don't hold your breath.
No, this is exciting. Don't play it down. I've brought you a brand new Motormouth cap.
Oh, brilliant.
And I don't know whether you're one of those people with a massive head like Harry.
I've got a small head.
Yeah, they don't fit me.
There you go. Try that
brilliant.
For size.
Okay, let's go.
I've got a larger one if it doesn't fit.
No,
oh, no, this is the small one.
Oh, is that the small?
There you go.
I reckon this is going to be a good...
These don't fit Harry because he's got unusually big head and not unusually big feet. Oh, beautiful, look at that.
Oh, right. Perfect. It's perfect.
There we are.
So on brand.
So
just one more thing we're not mentioning, Kelvin. You have to wear that every single day.
Yes, that is the rule, I'm afraid. Every racetrack you go to, every interview you do is now going to be Motormouth branded.
I'm going to check it on my little mirror on my phone.
Oh,
it's all right.
There you go.
Oh, perfect. Cheers, guys.
I was going to go flat peak, but I don't know. We've reached a certain age now. You're 35, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you see.
Can we still pull that off, that flat peak?
I don't think we can, to be honest with you.
I think you're right.
I think you're either a hat person or you're not, though, in general, I think.
You found the hat that fits your head?
I know, and I refuse to wear any hats, to be honest. I just they don't fit my head, and I don't suit it. Not having it. Not good for the look.
I don't want to bring this up at every single podcast we do, but Kelvin, you'll be impressed with this. Harry's feet are size 16.
Yeah, UK size 16. So he said this in our first episode. I don't think I'll ever be able to be, or would have ever
really?
Been able
you're
to be a racing
driver. You're not that tall, are you?
6'5".
Oh, you're 6'5"?
Yeah. Don't look that to
I must have just been in a daze this morning when I walked in. Yeah, I didn't. Yeah. It strike me as that 6'5" is massive, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so. No, it's in size 16 feet. So wow. It's the bane of my life, but also an incredible talking point.
It is. it's going to be a theme running through our podcast for sure. Listen, anyway, on to you, Kelvin. Enough about Harry's big freak. We've covered that enough in the last podcast.
Yeah.
So age 35, oldest of three brothers.
Yes.
So what do your other brothers do? Are they in the acting or motorsport game?
No. My Dean is the middle brother, the younger brother, 2 years younger than me. He's a barrister.
Wow.
He like me, we had a sabbatical at the same time. He kind of came away from law and was a little bit disillusioned. He'd worked as a solicitor as well, and he just wasn't feeling fulfilled, and had about 18 months out, and he just started working, I think now, down in Milton Keynes for...
Right.
Gone into the education sector, still in a law capacity, I think, overseeing a faculty within a big university there.
Right.
So he's doing well. He's very, me and him are chalk and cheese.
Really?
Absolutely opposites, but he's genuinely my best mate. And then our youngest brother, Braden, he's 22. He's got traits of that entertainment quality, you know, he wants to be centre of attention like most thespians. And as a kid, he did a lot of acting. I directed a short film, 2006 it was, and Braden played the lead. The lead was a boxer, and in his early years, in his child days, I cast Braden to play him, and he was great. He's got a great look. But he just never really kind of pursued it as much as I did.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, I just loved acting, and that's all I did really.
Did you get into it via acting school or?
Yeah, but with no real. A little bit, I'd say unorthodox, really, because I'm from quite a working class area, you know, just north of it, a place called Oldham, and that had a little amateur theatre company, if you like, called Oldham Theatre Workshop, which was quite well known within the area, and that was kind of, you know, responsible for pumping out quite a bit of talent, you know, people going into Coronation Street or Anna Freel, you know, these names throughout that have all started at the Oldham Theatre Workshop. So I went there because it was kind of synonymous within Oldham, and it was just something to do.
Yeah.
I played sport, played cricket, played rugby, played football. And I just started going to acting classes just for, you know, something different. And I absolutely loved it, you know, from, I think, 6 or 7 years old to be given
proper young.
Yeah, yeah. With no aspirations of being an actor, just purely because it was just something to do.
Yeah.
And it operated the same in which your local football team would operate. You know, you maybe go once, twice a week, pay your subs. And when you get to play a character or, you know, you're with somebody else and you say, right, Kelvin, pretend that you're really angry at this other guy. You don't know why. Go. And you just really embellish your personality and your imagination and just really kind of lose yourself in these. And as a kid with a big imagination, I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a really good foundation for not just for wanting to be an actor, but just socially anyway. You know, it helped work on my self-esteem and I got to mix with different people at school. You know, kids are quiet. You're in your little groups. Whereas with acting in that drama group, I could do scenes with a girl who was 13, 14 years old. Whereas at school, she wouldn't be seen.
Yeah.
I don't want to be near a young 8-year-old lad. It's just not cool. Whereas in acting, suddenly we're all together. And it was like that across every kind of social group within school.
It's like all the rules are out the window, really.
Exactly, yeah. So you've got to really mix and I think was quite unique to acting. And I don't really see that anywhere else. Not really within sport, certainly within school. That's what was great for me with the drama.
Yeah. Did drama school ever become a temptation, or you wanted to stay where you were?
Yeah, no, it did, yeah.
You just want to drop in here that you went to RADA.
I did want to drop that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you really? I love that. Did you?
Yeah, I'm only just sort of starting my sort of career, I suppose.
Okay.
And acting, so I trained at RADA after 12.
Well,
I know exactly. But I did because I started acting when I was probably, I don't know, 10 years old or whatever, but a little bit later, but for the exact same reasons. But it's a great way of also having to deal with rejection very early on.
Yeah. You've got to build that resilience.
Yeah, but
and
you
not
said
take things personally.
Exactly. But you and so I auditioned for 12 drama schools, got into one.
Right.
And that's kind of normal in a way, I think.
Yeah.
But you said drama school was.
I auditioned
kind of
for one. Yeah. It was. How old was I? I was probably 10 years old, and Sylvie. So now I've probably been acting 3 or 4 years, and I had an agent. I'd done quite a few little TV gigs, quite a few theatre gigs. I think I played at the London Palladium. I think it was on the back of the London Palladium. We did a play. Oldham Theatre Workshop took 20 students down there and we put on this play, at the, amongst other plays. It was like a bit of a collaboration of young theatre. And we were this working class, you know, town theatre group. And we stole the show. We had amazing reviews and I played the lead in this little play. And I think it was on the back of there I got contacted from Silver Young Theatre School.
Oh, yeah, a very
to
well
audition.
Known,
it was
yeah.
very prestigious. You know, that was where... And my parents, we couldn't afford to go there, you know. But it was for a scholarship. So I went for the audition, and it was hundreds and hundreds of children that went for this audition. And I got down to the last nine. So it was across all disciplines, singing, dancing, and acting. So
triple threat, yeah.
Triple threat. Well,
do you have a voice on you?
I found out that I'm not triple threat.
Oh, no. Does the singing let you down slightly?
No, it's I guess so, yeah. I mean, I can... I finished a musical back in the last year. You know, I'm
That's
not a great
not
singer.
Shabby,
I'd like to think I can hold a tune, yeah, but, you know. And I very nearly got in. And then what was quite nice, probably 5 years later, I'd probably maybe a year or two in Emmerdale, and then Sylvia Young got back in touch directly and asked to take me on, and it would be, you know, with absolutely no fees. She wanted what she wanted to me, and I said, well, actually, you auditioned me a few years ago, and you said no.
Oh,
and I was like, you know, and at the time, then looking back, I don't know if I could have moved away from home. I was very much a homeboy and loved my parents and my family, and it was so close knit. To suddenly, as a 10-year-old, to go and live in London with a, you know, with a, essentially an adopted fostered family.
It's a big
it's
move.
It's a massive move. And for me, I didn't really want to be an actor that much. It was just something I loved doing. Mm. And so I'm so glad in hindsight, looking back, that I never got through.
And then, of course, 20 years of Emmerdale followed.
Yes, I know.
How was it being out of it? Did you miss it?
No. And that's no disrespect, you know, to the show in any way. It was an amazing job, you know. But then it kind of got, you know, I think the last 5 years, I was kind of thinking, I just, with the dawn of Netflix and all these different platforms, the industry had changed massively. And from going back, you know, pre-2008, when the industry was doing absolutely nothing, there was no work out there, so suddenly there's this blossoming of work everywhere. And as an opportunity, I think, well, you know, I'd love to play that character. I've watched a guy in that show. I'd love to be able to do something like
yeah,
that. And I've never had the opportunity, so... And I left purely to do that, to test myself. And I want to do drama, I want to do film, I want to do radio, I want to do everything, you know.
Yeah, I suppose it's hard because spending that long in one program, you are going to get pigeonholed slightly naturally, aren't you?
Yeah,
it's like the guys that come out of Neighbours or whatever, you know, any soap. That it's hard to move away from that character.
Is it a good test of resilience as well? Because I imagine the hours are quite long when you're filming as well. And as you say, you're doing it day after day, the same character working on, you know, multiple storylines at a time, I suppose. Was it quite a good setup in that terms at the beginning of your career to sort of test you for it, really?
Yeah, I think there's one thing that it instilled in me, partly for my parents as well, especially my dad, was work ethic. Mm. And I think that's probably my strongest, you know, my asset, really, is that you can apply that to anything. Mm. But, you know, yeah, when I was 13, 14 years old, probably going through my GCSEs or getting ready for my GCSEs, I was in a comprehensive school in Oldham. I was getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning. My granddad was taking me over to Leeds. I'd do a morning filming where I was expected to, you're treated like a child, but you're expected to act like an adult, you know, to be professional, know your lines, know where to stand, have a certain set etiquette. You know, no one kind of teaches you that. No one came to me on first day and says, you're going to be filming on this major TV show. You know, people are going to stop you in the street and maybe say nasty things. No one prepares you for that. There's no script. There's no formula. You just kind of take it in as you know and learn on the job, really.
Yeah.
And then I'd finish at maybe midday, and then by 1 o'clock I'm in the playground kicking a ball around, you know, and being a normal kid, and very much wanted to be that normal kid, and almost cringing when the word Emmerdale comes up, because, you know, I just wanted to become so far away from that. I just wanted to fit in. I wanted to be absolutely normal, because I didn't want the attention brought to me for... Because with that is the negativity, naturally.
Yeah.
Maybe more so in a working class northern school, I don't know. But, you know, the amount of... So, yeah, there's an element of resilience that I built up, and I had to be thick-skinned. You know, the amount of insults I got. I wouldn't say bully. I hate that, you know, bullying, because it's a... But, yeah, there's terms of that where people would always be, you know, having
ribbing
a...
Ribbing you.
Yeah,
like
totally. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And you just... You take that on the chin and... Yeah. And I love school, you know, I was probably had the least attendance in the whole year. I think, you know, attendance was appalling because I was always at Emmerdale. But no, I loved it looking back. Great school, great friends. And I've, you know, my three of my five groomsmen were lads I went to school with. You know what I mean?
Wow.
My best mates to this day, the lads I met, I've known since I was 11 years old, so.
That's nice. Still grounded. It's what we like.
Well.
Now listen, before we turn off all the motorsport fans out there, we've got to get onto your racing.
Yeah.
So
they've already turned off, haven't they?
They probably have.
Not just an actor.
Come back.
Triple Threat is the third one. It's actually racing. So,
okay. So at what point did you think, okay, I'm going to turn my hand to racing cars?
So I've been a car fanatic since, you know, the stories of when I used to go to bed with a spanner. My dad was a diesel fitter back then, a truck mechanic. And that naturally you aspire to what your dad, well, I did anyway. I wanted to do what my dad did. So I'd be under the dining room table, pretending to fix cars, fix trucks. And I've been as a spectator, anything with an engine, whether it be British superbikes, British touring cars, F1, any capacity like that. I used to go watching either on the TV or at the racetracks, Silverstone, Donington, Alton Park. I've visited all those places as a spectator with my dad. And then at the tender old age of 28, I was at the Autosport show, and I'd been there a couple of times before at the NEC. And there was the BRSCC stand with a Mini, Mighty Mini Championship, just there in its full livery. And my dad had bought me a Mini when I was about 13 or 14. We had in the on the drive, and I used to just tinker with it. Because back then I was in Emmerdale, I was acting, I loved acting, but I still had these aspirations to have my own car garage and be a mechanic. Or, you know, this is where I thought it was going. I didn't know. I was constantly being told by my careers advisor at school, acting's not sustainable. You can't be an actor, think of something else. So I was like, all right, okay. You know, at the time I was earning a good living. I was probably earning more than the careers advisor, but she constantly reminded me of the fact that this isn't going to last.
Yeah.
So part of me was like, well, I think it bloody will, because I'm going to make it last. Yeah. But if it doesn't, then I'll have a backup plan. And my backup plan was car orientated. So, so we reminisced. We saw this car at the car show, and I said, do you remember when we had that Mini? And there was a piece of paper next to it, kind of a bit of a to-do list, a checklist of what you needed. You needed an ARS license, you needed a car, and racing overalls and a helmet, and you go racing. It was literally broken down. It was that simple. So I rang up the championship organiser the week after and says, I've never raced, never done anything, never go-karted. I've been on stag do's and always done quite well at go-karting. Not as well as your brother-in-law, but, you know, I never won by a minute.
Hat tip, Adam.
But I'd always done quite well. But then again, I was quite slim and quite light. So maybe that was, I don't know. But, and 28 years old, I'd had some pretty tasty cars along the way, and I always felt like I could drive them and I could handle them. And I said, listen, I'm going to give it a go. What do I need to do? So he helped put me in touch with a chap, I'll give him a mention, Howard Hunt, who still teaches now. He did my ARDS test, my ARDS license. A chap was selling a car, a little Mighty Mini. And this is like a 60 brake horse, single point injection, you know, 1275. Standard tyres, you'd get them buffed down at Demon Tweaks to 4mm. So there'd still be movement in the block, but you know, it's certainly not a slick. It's just a normal tyre. Roll cage, standard box. Like I say, 60 brake horse. It's a road car that's just on the track.
Yeah.
It's 30 minutes on track. I think it was probably best part of $3,000 or $4,000 over the year. You know, 6-7 round championship, away you go. That was it. Signed up, and you know, round one at Alton Park, I'm there with a big X on the back. And that was it. It was a baptism of fire. I'd been there a week before doing a track day. I didn't know about TSL or anything like that. But somebody had told me that these minis were doing 2:20, I think, around the thing in. The last guy was doing 2:30, 2:35, so probably a 15-second disparity between the two. And I thought, well, if I'm somewhere in the middle, I'll be happy. But I didn't really have any gauge of where I wanted. I just wanted to race.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was my first race, and that was it. I was hooked, as they say.
So what year was this?
This was 2012.
So the first recollection that we have of you going into competitive racing, 2014, Porsche Carrera Cup. Is it fair to say that was your first sort of real hardcore bit of racing?
Yeah, I'd say. What did I do in 13? I think it was 13. In 13, I think I did. Can't remember actually. I think straight from the Mini, I did in the Carrera GT3 Challenge.
Yep.
Which was like a feeder series to the Carrera Cup. So the cars were 3 or 4 years old, but they were still slick tyres, sequential box, you know, 420 brake horse or whatever they were.
Yeah, and machine.
I went in that straight from a Mini and with a team. Yeah, it was crazy. And back then I managed to find some budget I couldn't afford at that level. You know, I could pocket spending $5,000-$6,000 in my first year of racing in my Mini. That was, for me, that was an expensive hobby. And at this point, it was still very much a hobby.
Well, yeah, did you know about the cost that involved in going racing?
Well, yeah, there was an opportunity to go Porsche racing, and it was, you know, $30,000 or whatever it were for the year. And I was like, what? And even that's still pretty, you know, in realms of racing.
Yeah, yeah,
in the grand scheme of things.
But I was like, 30,000 and people pay this? And I'm like, yeah. And I was like, well, I'm not paying it. And two, you know, if I did have the money, I just don't know if... I love racing, but I don't love it that much.
£30,000 worth,
Yeah, and then... you know, I've just got this knack where I think, well, I can make this work. And I was a guy on TV, I had a big profile. This Mini Championship I'd done extremely well at. And as a novice, I put it on pole in qualifying with an X that had never been done before. And I just naturally had a bit of a knack for it, albeit, you know, with no disrespect, I was racing against club racers, so they're probably not. But I'd say the first 5-10 drivers in that mini championship out of the 30 guys, these are keen racers. They're racing, they're pretty handy, especially around the mini. Mini's got a very select group where people just love racing minis, and there is a bit of a knack with these mini guys, you know. Not everybody can get in a mini and be as quick as some of the guys because they've just got a real knack with them. And I made it work, and that was when the whole other side of racing that people don't see is engaging with sponsors and getting somebody to help you. And I felt business. That there was an opportunity there because there's people sponsoring within motorsport, and my way of thinking was, why don't they come and sponsor me? Because I've got something a little bit different, and it's got to. I'm not saying that I'm better than anybody else, but like anything, you've got to utilize what you've got different and what's unique. And my unique selling point was that, so I leveraged that, and with value to the person who sponsored me. Not, I'm not just taking from them. It was a constant. It still is to this day. There's got to be genuinely something in it for them. Mm. They've got to come away from this. That's how I do everything. It's got to be completely fair. And if they're not happy, if I feel like I'm getting the lion's share, then I don't want that relationship because I'm too honest. I'd rather not continue. So I genuinely want them to get something massively out of it and think that they're on a great. They're getting some, you know, something great, and it'll continue. So,
yeah. And how was it stepping into a British touring car for the first time?
That was mad. Yeah, that was crazy. That was, I think, about 2 months before that. I was all set to do the Carrera Cup, and I'd not raced the year before that. So this is best part of 18 months I've not been in a race car. I'm about to do a half a season of Carrera Cup, and then Adam Weaver rang me and said, Kelvin, did I ring him actually? I think we're just chatting over text or Twitter or something. About it was around the Autosport time, and then he said, listen, you know, come and down see the cars, which fancy touring cars. Are like, there's no way I can you know, go to that level. I've got like 2 years under my belt of racing, and I was all right at club level, but certainly not touring car level. And not only that, I've not got the funds. That's telephone numbers. Yeah. And he was like, no, you know, I think we could do something. And at the time, I think Josh Cook had left, like, you know, kind of, they were hoping that Josh would be there, but either way, there was an opportunity to go there for very, you know, not very much money at all. And I went and met him, and I shook on it, and I shook on a deal that I didn't have the funds for, and I was confident that, and it was a lot of money, you know, not in racing money, but it was a lot
in
of
general,
money
in general. Yeah,
and I had a good idea that we'll get there. I rang my dad out. I got in the car, rang my dad, I said, Dad, I've just shook hands there with British Touring Car. And he almost cried with that. It was because me and him have watched it from being kids. And I said, but you know, it's quite a bit of money. He says, we'll find a way. Now, not that doesn't mean my dad's going to pay for it, because we've not got those funds. Do you know what I mean? I'm like I said, I'm working class. We can't think of that. But at the time, I had a couple of sponsors who I knew had appetite, and I knew I could, you know, pitch them an angle and I could make it work. So I did. We got the funds together, a very skeleton budget. And I went into a free practice one at Brands Arch in front of I don't know how many thousand people. That was the first time I drove the car.
No testing or anything?
No testing, no budget to test, no testing. And this is what people don't realise, you know. I don't think there's any other person who's ever done British touring cars having passed their arts test 3 years prior. I don't think there's anyone who's ever done British touring cars and the first time they get in the car is free practice one at Brands Hatch.
No, that's fast tracking.
That is fast tracking. And that's not me thinking that, yeah, I can handle this. No. This is an opportunity. It might not ever come again. I've grown up with Jason Plato, Matt Neal. These people are like heroes to me. I'd meet soap stars and singers, whoever, during my acting career and not really be that phased because suddenly I'm get a chance to be on. And I felt embarrassed to thinking, I'm really sorry, but you're going to be racing me. You know, I'm sorry to be here.
How did they receive you? I mean, you can imagine. I mean,
the top boys really well
since. But was there any like, what's this guy doing? Of course, turning up from, you know, massively. Yeah.
You know, your Platos, your Matt Neals, Gordon Shannons, they were absolutely lovely. You know, that's the thing. They are the top of their game, and they were the one guys who were lovely. Probably thought he's not going to do anything, but they embraced me and loved the fact that I was bringing a completely different demographic. You know, because audience-wise, I'm bringing. I got a lot of coverage with ITV and stuff like that, so it was a lot of spotlight that was put onto me that everybody gets the benefit of. The whole championship get the benefit of. But then, majority of the guys were, you know, what is he doing here? He's making us look, and that's it. You know, they just didn't have any respect for me. And because if I come into their championship, if it looks like anybody can do it, then it discredits them. They like to think of themselves that they're these amazing, untouchable Mark Marquezes. And to be frank, not everybody is, you know. And motorsport is accessible. Anyone can go and do British GT. Anyone can go and do British touring cars, within reason. You've got to be at a pretty competent pace, but you know, I'm living proof of that. Do you know what I mean? You can do it. So, but they don't want you to think that.
But you've shown your credentials now. So, you know, 2017 into British GTs, 2018 British GT Championship, finishing second in the Pro-Am and ninth overall. So I guess the perception has changed of you now, where they're like, this guy's a serious competitor.
I think he's serious about racing. You know, I think that's still the common. But I'm pretty, well, I know, you know, throughout a lot of the motorsport people, whether it's drivers, whether it's the fans, they still don't really take me seriously. I'm still not a good peddler. And I don't think I ever will be considered that. I could go and win a championship and still might not consider, because the minute they accept that, then, oh, he's an actor and he's a racing driver.
Yeah. How can he possibly be both?
Yeah. And for some stupid reason, they feel that it discredits them. It doesn't at all. But, you know, that's what... Even in British touring cars, I was probably... I don't know, maybe in quali- I could never get the best. I'm struggling with that now, still qualifying. I'd be mad, you know, I could always be like 1.5, 2 seconds off. But in a race, I'd be matching most people's pace, you know. And you look back now, oh, you didn't do well. People say it to me all the time, you didn't do well in touring cars, did you? You know, and I was like, well, I think I did. I think I did all right.
Yeah.
I was probably the only person as well on that who got paid that year.
Yeah.
Maybe played to a few others, but I did it in such a way where I knew my budget and I got more. And
you made it work for you.
I made it work for me, you know. And I don't think I'm ever going to kind of rid those demons, that negativity. I still get it probably now, you know. But I know I'm comfortable with what I'm doing racing-wise now. I'm racing with Martin Plowman now, who's, you know, he's won Le Mans. He's done Indy Lights, done the Indy 500. The guy can drive. You know, I think he's just been downgraded to a gold. He was quite happy with that from Platinum, because of the Platinum drivers, you just struggle to get any drives.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, within every week, most weekends now, I'm within 0.4 of him. You know, in some practice sessions, I'm quicker than him. And we're keeping each other, you know. Martin's still a better driver than me, without doubt, but he's helping develop me in such a way that I'm on his heels, and that's where I want
to
be.
Great resource for you to be able to tap into.
Oh, massively, yeah. Amazing, yeah.
Yeah.
Am I right in saying you maybe weren't quite sure of what exactly he'd done before you met him in terms of, like, his racing credentials?
Yeah, I didn't really know, yeah. Because I was a little bit ignorant to that. He'd done, because it was obviously overseas.
So yeah, of course.
I'd not seen any of that, but he's done amazing things.
Yeah. And we're getting, outside of this podcast and other things, we're getting a bit of a glimpse into your life as a racing driver, as a dad, and various other bits and pieces that you're getting up to with Behind the Visor. So tell us a little bit about that and the thinking behind that. We've obviously got your camera here today.
Yeah, we've got Rich filming today.
Tell us a bit about the concept and why you started this.
I started because I wanted to, you know, I had a couple of ideas to pitch to production companies, TV companies, about 18 months ago, and it's the hardest sell ever. You know, motorsport, not everybody's into motorsport. I can't understand why, because I think it's the best thing ever, but unfortunately not everybody is. And it seems to be not every TV channel and TV production company are, and it just seems like a really hard sell. So I wanted to kind of think, well, if no one else is going to take a punt, and whether it's not just a documentary about me, but all these different formats I kind of had and had an idea of, I just couldn't really get much traction. And then I just thought, well, I'll almost do my own teaser, my own taste, and do it myself. Yeah. So that's how it started. I touched base with a friend of mine who's got a little production company, and I said, listen, this is what racing is to me. This is how a racing weekend looks. But there's a whole element of racing that people don't see. That it's, you know, it's in the garage afterwards. It's in the barbecues of the family.
Yeah.
That to me is completely accessible and completely relatable to everybody. You know, and that's what I want to try and capture. Yeah. And so this has just been the start. We're only kind of 2 or 3 episodes in. And it's we won. There'll be at least 7 race weekends in there, 7 episodes dedicated to the race. But then I want to try and show people away from racing and what I get up to, you know, stuff like this, anything really, just to kind of give people that insight. And that little bit of exclusive content is great on social media platforms, and it helps to kind of push me as my brand, and just to let people see what people are always asking me, what you're up to, you know, what you're doing, whether it's in the street or on Twitter or whatever. And I think visually this is an opportunity to be able to show them, you know, what it, a little, you know,
absolutely,
piece of what it is. What
I mean, we've talked about this before, that, you know, with motorsport, you're behind a visor most of the time, you're tucked away in a car, and people don't see the other side of it. You know, championships like British Touring Cars, British GT, whatever, you can get into the paddock, but the higher up you go, you know, go up to Formula One, and these people are just so inaccessible. And it's so nice to be able to see what goes on behind the scenes. If you're not in the industry, you just don't see what a paddock is.
If someone from Formula One looked at Behind the Visor, what you were doing, that's all they need to do to make it a million times more accessible for anyone and everyone, because it is, as we say, it's not just about the racing. A lot of people go there for the drama and the action, but what makes, I think, motorsport that community and that family feel is what you see or what you don't see, frankly, you know, in terms of how they prepare for it, what happens straight after the race, you know.
That's it. We've kind of got a plan for this. Is going to be over the next, you know, 6 to 12 months. I want to engage, you know, when I'm meeting my sponsors or pitching to new sponsors, you know, capture that and see what goes on there, because that's almost like a bit of a taboo subject. No one talks about that. But that facilitates all the racing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, a lot of it maybe comes from family business and things like that. But ultimately, certainly for me, I'm sponsored. I wouldn't be here if I wasn't sponsored. So I want to showcase and show how I go about that. You know, I don't have a manager. I do everything myself. Every sponsorship I've ever attained has come from me, from knocking on doors, from emailing people, which is always a bit strange when they'll receive an email from the guy who used to play on this subject, and they're thinking, is this, surely he's got people who do this for him?
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I do it. And I get in the door, that gets me in the meeting, I walk in, and you can kind of see whether it's board directors or the marketing team, and they're like, well, this is really strange, but, you know. And I'm like, well, hi guys, you know, this is my reason, this is my pitch, this is what I do, this is a bit about me. And this is where I think I could be value to you. And I'll try and utilize all my other strengths or my other, you know, unique selling points. And 9 times out of 10, it'll be a no. Yeah. And I walk away and I'm not defeated, but I'm so used to getting no's.
Well,
exactly,
you're trained for it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm already, you know, I don't take it personally. I just don't think they've seen the opportunity one. And I'll maybe tweak my proposal for the next one. And the guys that do say, yeah, you know, then yeah, you can, you know, there's value for both people.
How do you balance your two worlds? Do you have to sort of take time out of one to focus on the other, or is there a way of keeping both on at the same time?
I'm still trying that whole spinning plates thing. Yesterday, I was looking after my two kids, and the team manager rang, and I was like, everything was a compromise, and I'm just not very good at, you know, it was like, I can't do it, you know. And so that's what I need to get better at. At the minute, it's just I have a day of, right, you know, everything but motorsport-based, whether that's engaging with potential sponsors or speaking with a team or speaking with a player, whatever it might be, organising this documentary, whatever, you know, kind of do that for a day and then move on to something else. Mm. I'm not great at kind of spinning plates. And then naturally there's got to be balance with family, because that's sometimes quite an easy thing to put, you know, you not take them for granted, but, you know, you realise that it's been 3 or 4 days, 5 days, and you've not spent a day with your wife and your children, and you think, yeah, that's the most important thing, so I need to address that.
Mm.
Two young kids, right?
Yeah.
Boys, girls?
A five-month-old boy and a 2.5-year-old daughter, yeah.
They're hard work, aren't they?
Have you got kids?
I've got two. I've got a 4-year-old, just 4, and a 1-year-old. Right. Neither sleep.
Oh, really?
So I don't sleep.
You look well, though. You don't look like you're tired. You. Yeah, you look well.
It's all the makeup we put on before
you
came.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. It's all the moisturiser.
What moisturiser? There's your chance. They need a moisturiser.
I've never moisturised in my entire life.
No. Really?
Splash of water. That's all you need.
Splash of water.
That's what keeps this face so pretty.
Wow. Okay.
But yeah, two young kids, and they don't sleep at all. But I'm dying to get the 4-year-old in a go-kart. Because those little Bambinos, you know, the little Bambino cars, they're so cool. I'm desperate to get them in a go-kart, but the wife's not too keen, you know, with the costs escalating rather quick.
Especially with go-karting.
Even go-kart, I mean, £100,000 a year, you could easily swallow in go-karting.
Easily.
Wow.
Yeah. Easily.
Yeah. No,
I know
crazy.
People that have done double that.
Yeah,
it's just, it's obscene.
So you're obviously a petrol head. I've been reliably informed you're into your modern classics, your 80s, 90s and so on. You're obviously a fan of motorsport. How far does that love of motorsport go? Do you watch all forms of motorsport? Do you watch two-wheel motorsport? Do you like the Formula One?
Two-wheel is the biggest thing I watch, yeah. MotoGP, World Superbike, British Superbike is what, that's what really turns me on, if you like. I think that is, I'm in absolute awe of those guys.
Yeah.
I do quite a few track days down at Donington on the Ran Asm School, and it's always been on my bucket list to do a race. I was going to do something with Kawasaki last year, but it didn't come off as a wild card. I've not got my race license yet for a bike, but that's what I would definitely want to do. And but I'd be probably 10, 15 seconds off Leon around, you know, on a stock bike around Donington. Yeah. Whereas in a car, I could get within a second of most people.
Yeah.
Whereas on a bike, it's just so exposed, and that's why I've got such respect for those guys.
They're completely mental.
It's amazing what they can do, you know. And especially your Leon Aslams, your Johnny Reyes, your Mark Marquez's, Cal, you know, those. They just I'm just in
on
absolute
another level.
Awe of what they can do on a machine. So that's what I spend my days watching. Car racing, British touring cars is great to watch, you know, the circus element of it's just crashing and contact, but there's some really, really good racing. And as a spectacle, as a brand, I think it's you know, there's nothing comes close to it. I think that's why it's so good. British ET is good, but after I've done a race, I won't watch it back. I'll just probably try and watch the last 10, 15 minutes, you know. A bit boring, isn't it? Racing.
Ooh.
Controversial. It gets good in the last 15 minutes, doesn't
it? Well, it's a bit like F1, isn't it? You know, but people tend to
watch the first 10
laps. I'm not an F1 fan, you know.
Single seaters? Any single seaters?
No. I've never driven a single seater, no. I've not driven many race cars. I've probably driven 5 cars in my whole life.
Is it an aspiration, or are you not too fast?
I'd love to have a go in a single seater, yeah.
What do you make of stuff like, you know, the new motorsport era? We've got electric coming in now, like things like Formula E. I don't know how familiar you are with that, but you also got the new electric motorbike championship that's sort of on the way and being talked about. Is that something you kind of have a little inkling with? Or?
I've watched Formula E a couple of times, and it looks quite the fan boost. I didn't get that. That I kind of dipped into that, but but it sounds cool, you know. And why not? You know, if there's that's the future it's going to be, then embrace it. You know, the thought of there being no V8s, literally like a little peace inside of me dies, because I think how can we that sound is what's, you know, I went to Monaco at the weekend and they were quite loud. It's that, so it almost feels like a suction thing of the cars going past, and it just doesn't sound nowhere near as good as I've been on historic days and heard
they sound incredible.
And I'm just like, that is it, because the racing in Formula One especially is boring. It's a process, you know. It's just not really. Give it some razzmatazz with sound and
The sound was all part of it. I mean, I've been in Formula One for about 15 years, and I remember back in the day, you know, when I used to work with ING Bank, who at the time was sponsoring the Renault F1 team. And at that time, they were still these monster engines, and the cars sounded amazing. And you sit in the stands, and you couldn't have a conversation. You couldn't talk like this next to a racetrack. Now in Monaco, where you've obviously been there now, you know, you could sit on a boat in the T jetty and have a perfectly normal conversation with a car 20 meters away.
It's just
not the same, and you don't get that hairs on the back of the neck standing up, because the noise just isn't there anymore.
Yeah. The first race I ever went to and saw in the flesh was the 2013 British Grand Prix, and I simply went as just a fan, me and my dad, and it was pouring with rain, it was miserable, but the roar of the engines when they came past and the cars, you had to have earplugs.
Yeah.
Now, when I've been since, it's bewildering to me that you don't need that, and you can perfectly have a conversation, you don't need to put the earplugs in, because that is all surely part of the experience of motorsport.
Yeah. And sadly it's not there, but but it's still, I think, quite exciting to watch, and I wouldn't want to be too negative about you know, they obviously feel there's a niche, there's a need for it out there, there's an appetite for it there. So I'd like to think if that continues to succeed, then motorsport naturally as a whole will feel the benefits. So
And I think Formula One as a spectacle is still amazing.
Oh, it's still,
that's what it's there for.
Exactly. I mean, the Monaco Grand Prix is a special place to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, while it's quite often a procession, it's still an incredible thing to witness and see the cars that close up and the way they corner. It is spectacular.
Yeah.
And it's still the top of the tree, isn't it, when it comes to motor racing?
Well, you say you were there. How was it? What were you up to in Monaco?
I've been once before, but obviously never on an F1 weekend, so it was my first time. I went with my teammate, Plowy, our sponsors took us, Cruising, so I met with those guys about a year ago, and at a golfing event. My missus tells me, there's no, you know, I always say golfing's like work, and she says, it's not work. How can it be? Well, you know, it is. And that was another one of my crazy ideas, where I pitched an idea to those guys, and they liked it, and you know, we're now affiliated with one another, and they're great. And one of the perks of having them guys on board was that they took us to Monaco F1, you know, to experience. They do quite a bit with F1 experiences, and they do like an F1 experience with some of their guests. And it was great just to go along as a spectator, really. It was just amazing. I probably indulged in the social side a little bit too much, you know.
Ah, you got it, haven't you?
I got Plowy drunk. He's not a big drink. Yeah, he's not a big drink.
He's a little chap, isn't he?
Yeah, he can't
say too much.
He's just too nice. And I just said, come on, come with me.
On a yacht?
We got on a yacht, got on a yacht, which
Monaco
was nice.
Monaco
was
in Monaco with that yacht,
I've never been on one of these big super, I kept calling it a boat, I think it was the guy who owned it.
It's the Northern coming in.
Yeah, it's a lovely boat, this. Bolt? And I was like, yacht? I couldn't think of the word, I was like, yacht, yeah, sorry. So that was my first time, I got excited, I think I did a little Instagram video when I was on there, but I was just like a kid in a sweet shop. It was, you know, it was amazing. And seeing the F1 cars, you know, whether this loud or not, it's an F1 car. It's driving, you know, it's just like, this is amazing. This is just, met some great people. It was sunshining. I had quite a lot to drink. And yeah, amazing weekend.
Brilliant. And in terms of your ambitions, what do you want to do with your racing? Where do you want to take it? Where do you want to get to?
I want to win a championship, whether that's a collective effort with myself and Martin or, you know, me further on the line doing a single, you know, sprint championship, sprint series. And I think it's in us, you know, this year, especially with current leading Pro-Am. We're going up against, I think, 18 silver drivers. And so it's very, very competitive. But we're both confident that as a pairing, me as an amateur, we can still mix it with a pro, you know, we can still mix it and get the overall win. So that's what is eluding us at the minute, the overall. I think we've had an overall podium so far, but we've not had an overall win. So yeah, first and foremost, I want to win the Pro-Am this year, and we've set targets of being, you know, up there with the overall, you know, maybe top five. So it's a massive challenge. But in the future, I don't know. I don't really set any real targets because it can go so many different ways. I want to do rallycross. I definitely want to go in one of those cars. Yeah. I want to do a bike race. I'd love to go back to British touring cars, you know, one day in the future. Now I'm a little bit more experienced, I think, and I know what it's about. You know, the racing is probably the worst thing about that. I had 11 DNFs. One was genuinely my fault when I made a lunge on Cole at the airpin at Croft. The rest, I just, because I was qualifying 20th, 25th, you know, it was just, there's just too much contact. Yeah. There's just too much contact. The skill of, I remember watching, I think it was Matt Neal Gordon shared it. Josh Cook was leading at Alton Park and he led for all the race. I think it might have been Gordon Shedden who was behind him in the end, got frustrated and just tapped, you know, just moved him out of the way.
Yeah.
I think it was at turn one. But the skill it took for Cook to defend like that in a slower car, it was just like amazing. For them to be all forgotten about and it's the attacker that gets applauded, it's just not fair, you know. I've defended before and it's harder than to, it's so hard. And when the guys do it, and I just think that's not being, he's not got the credit for that. He's not got the, you know, and that's the real shame. And I think that's huge within touring cars. So if I was to go back, I'd be obviously mindful of that. But Le Mans 24 Hours has been thrown about, you know. Now I'm kind of in that endurance racing element. And that, you know, obviously would be amazing. But we were kind of Bathurst. We were thinking, you know, there's so much to kind of, I'm reluctant to set my sights on just one. Yeah, I'm just want to explore. And I'm still, what I mean, 5-6 years into racing, I'm still that guy that I honestly remember looking through that wire fence thinking, God, those guys are so lucky.
Yeah.
And I get to do it now, you know, and it's crazy. And on a weekend, I'll text some of my friends, and I saw a little kid the other week, and I let him sit in the race car, and the Aston Martin, you know, I'm like, this is just insane, isn't it? You know, I'm so lucky. Yeah. I work hard and I try and leverage absolutely everything I've got and I can do, but I'm still so lucky.
Oh,
there's
amazing.
So many bike drivers out there that are probably quicker than me that are not, you know, but at the same time, I'm holding my own and on my day, with 6 years experience, you know, I think I'm very proud of what I'm doing and my achievements so far.
And you've obviously learned a lot in those 6 years. So if you could go back to Kelvin 6 years ago and say, listen, you're about to go into your first race, here's what you should do. I guess you were sort of wet behind the ears then thinking, I'm just going to go for it, see what happens. What would you tell your past self if you could go back in time?
That's a good question, that. What would I tell myself? I don't know. I think I've always done things quite, I don't think I change anything. I've always drove with an element of somewhat reservation. I've never been absolutely all out, you know, because I've always had the money thing at the back of my head. If I bend this, you know, who's going to pay for it? Monday morning is going to be a horrible Monday morning. Some people, you know, have not got that issue, so they can race slightly differently. I wish I could be more like that. So I've always been a little bit cautious of my whole approach and just savouring. I didn't race at all, like I mentioned, in 2015.
Yeah.
One, because I couldn't get any budget. Two, because I was just too busy with doing other stuff. So I know what it's like to not race. So I genuinely love the fact that I'm able to race.
That's interesting. So do you think if there was a bottomless pit of cash, do you think it would change your driving style to a degree? Because you'd be thinking, if I bin this, it actually doesn't matter too much. Do you think you may be holding back a little bit because of the money side?
Yeah, 1,000,000%, without doubt, Not that I'd be reckless, but, you know, I'd be absolutely... At Snetterton, you know, turn one was there a few weeks ago. If you go in there, if you push sometimes, before you know it, you've got that barrier on the inside. You know, I've seen some massive accidents there, and you shouldn't be going into a race weekend thinking of stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, you know... You do. I don't know if any other guys would admit that, but certainly I do.
Yeah, yeah.
And you want to be quite cautious. You want to, you know, be, you know, the championship's not won at round two.
Yeah.
You know, so there's all these things that play into it, but certainly damage and budget does play into it massively. At Alton Park, the first round of the year, one of the young McLaren lads, he was a lap down. It was a final lap. I'm sitting third overall. I'm confident I can make a pass in the last corner just to get second overall. Three of us going to the chicane. And this lad who's a lap down, you know, makes a mistake, gets sausage and goes straight on and does me up, you know, up from behind. you know, and it wasn't my fault. And he apologised and it was a mistake. That's fair enough. It's usually frustrating, the fact that it was a lap down. But, you know, that's racing.
Yeah.
That was 12 and a half, 13 grand. £13,000, you know. We seem to forget within racing these. And then we actually sit down and think, £13,000.
Yeah. In the real world,
that's a test day, test and a half for us, just gone if we budgeted for that. So, you know, that's... and it wasn't even my... If I was pushing and made that mistake, you can somewhat take it on the chin. But when you're literally a sitting duck, you've done nothing wrong. So it's things like that are at the back of my mind. Because, so wrong or right, you know, I wish they wasn't there. If I had that endless pit of money, I'd certainly be a lot more committed, I think, in my approach, and maybe be a couple of tenths quicker.
And who's your best pal in racing? Presumably it's Plowy.
Yeah, you know, he's my teammate. I'm blessed with him. He's one of the quickest on the grid, but he's a genuine, like, a lovely, lovely... He's almost too nice. You know, I'm still searching for that element of, you know, there's... Come on, I want to find that. And he's just too nice. If you cut him in half, you just see little butterflies and love hearts. And he's just... His family's the same. His family remains. So I almost feel like I've hit the jackpot. Apart from doing a Bathurst or Le Mans 24 Hours, there's genuinely nobody I would want to do it more with than Martin and his family. They kind of come as the package, and for a race weekend for me, spending time with them is just as good as the race. And however corny that sounds, but that is, because in racing it's littered with, you know, everyone's on their own mission, their own journey. So there's a lot of selfish, you know. But this is the first time I've kind of met someone who I genuinely feel like there's no agenda. There's just a genuine love to do well, and he wants me to do well as well. There's no jealousy. There's absolutely nothing. Even if, you know, you've got this actor who's, I think at FP1 or FP2 at SNET. Or was it Alton? I think I beat him by a tenth. And it was just Kelvin that he said, that's amazing. He was so absolutely loving it. Yeah. Somebody else would have been a little bit annoyed at that. Yeah. You know, want to go again. And he loves that. And then he'll go and put two or three tenths on me again in the next set. And then I have to go again. But that's just what you want, you know.
Pushing
and,
each other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Is it nice having there, especially if it is a tough weekend, sort of psych yourself up? How do you do that? Is it good having people around you like that? Or is that within yourself?
Yeah, I don't know. I used to, when I used to play sport, you know, when if it was a rugby game, you can psych yourself up. You know that you can with that input, you can have an output. You know, if I'm really, really tired or real, I can just push in a really... With motorsport, I don't know, you can't get that same sort of psych in a car. So I just try and stay the opposite. I'm the absolute as relaxed as possible.
Right.
I don't really have a plan. I just want to be, you know, relaxed and be as quick as I can, but naturally have some strategy in a sense of where I want to push and where I don't want to push. And so yeah, for me, my race weekends are very simple. Martin will set the benchmark. He will show what the car can do. Collectively, we'll set the car up. We drive very, very similar, so we have always the same feedback. So the car's set up in a certain way. Martin will set the time, and I'll get as close. That's all my focus is that weekend, to get as close as that time. I don't worry about anybody else or anything, because everything else will look after itself. If I'm as quick as Martin, we'll do well. You know what I mean? So that's all. That's how simple I keep it.
And do you have a racing idol?
Valentino Rossi.
Two wheels again. You need to get on two wheels. This needs to happen.
Yeah. Valentino Rossi, I think he's the man, isn't he? Colin McRae, so I love rally. That's what I want to do, you know. Colin McRae, I was a huge fan of. Tommy Mäkinen, I went out and bought a Tommy Mäkinen Lancer Evolution 6 when I was about 18, 19 on the back of, not in red, the famous one, but yeah, at the back of his exploits. But I was a big fan of Jason Plato, I guess. Plato was a big...
I think for our age group, people like Plato, back in, you know, when they were showing the British touring cars, you know, week in, week out on telly, he was the man, you know, when I was growing up, certainly.
Andy Rouse and Steve Soper with it, because my favourite car to this day is a Ford Escort, you know, Escort RS 500, so, Ford Sierra Escort 500, so that was my, seeing those guys bap around Brands Hatch and places like that.
What was your first car?
As on the road,
yeah, ever. What was the first thing you got in?
A Volkswagen Polo GTI.
Ooh. Quite punchy for a first car.
Punchy, yeah. 1.6, I think, like 140 brake or something like that.
Yeah,
had some BK racing alloys. I was a bit of a
How long did it last?
Oh, good, yeah. I went through all my family. I had it for 2 years, and then my brother had it for a couple of years, and his best mate had it for a couple. I think it's still going.
Did he have the 6x9s and the subwoofer in the back?
I didn't have the 6x9 subwoofer, no. I did in my next car after that, yeah. I got another car after that, and then I put some 6x9s and a subwoofer in the back of that, yeah. But yeah. I used to tear ass around that, so the subwoofer would always come off its brackets and be messing up, you know, left or right in the boot. So
what have you got at the moment?
I don't have a car at the minute.
Do you not?
I use my dad's quite a bit. So I'm the family moving away, I think, at the end of this year, me and my family. So we kind of sold our, my last car was an M3.
Right.
Oh, lovely.
In Yas Marina Blue. So nice.
Oh, lovely.
I've been using different pool cars that my dad's kindly been letting me use of late, so.
Okay.
A bit boring.
Now listen, we won't keep you too much longer. We know you're a busy chap.
I've loved this, guys. It's great.
I'm glad you're enjoying
it. Yeah.
Couple of random ones for you. Just moving away from motorsport a little bit. You've obviously recently taken part in a very interesting TV show where we saw much more of you than
you'd like.
I'm never going to unsee those images.
Sorry about that.
But the Full Monty, obviously amazing experience. Yeah. How did you get into that, and then what a thing to do?
Yeah, amazing. I had reservations naturally when I was first asked. It was November, I think, December. I was in London doing a musical, and my agent rang and says, the show, I've been in touch. And I was like, the show where you get naked? He was like, yeah. And I'd never seen it before, but I was aware of it. And I was like, absolutely no way. And I said no. He came back and said that IT really want you to do it. Whether he was just saying that, I don't know. But I said no again. So I was adamant. Not because I thought it was a great show. I'd never seen it. But I didn't want to get my kit off. It didn't really feel very credible for me. And I'd misinterpreted the sentiments of the show, you know. So he said, watch the show. So I sat down and watched it. And I was blown away. I was like, wow, this is not about getting your kids. Yeah, you get your kids off, but it's certainly not about that at all. The message is so much deeper than that. It's to raise awareness and to kind of say, we as celebrities on you know, I've put my hands up there and used
inverted
commas, just in case you think that was... the guys listening couldn't see that. But yeah, it's more about us. If we are willing to bear on in front of millions of people, then for you to go and see your doctor and get checked, it's not that big of a deal. And that's all it is, really, you know, so... And I almost felt like I had a duty, you know, and also not a duty, but an opportunity as someone in the public eye with a big following, you know, as representing a younger audience. Yeah, go and do it, Kelvin, you know. And looking back, it's probably the best job I've ever done.
Yeah.
It was honestly, it was life-changing at moments. The guys I met were unbelievable. What a lovely bunch of guys from all different backgrounds, different shapes and sizes. And with no real inhibitions, you know, I was the one probably most thinking about getting my kit off. And they were like, Kelvin, you know, you work out, you look all right. Willie was saying that, Willie Thorne, and he's 60-year-old and a bit overweight. And it wasn't about how we looked. It was just about, you know, bearing all and kind of saying, you know, here you are. And and it was amazing, a great experience. And we raised so much awareness. And the amount of guys that stopped me in the street said, I watched that show you did. What a lovely show. Yeah. And you know what? I've gone and got myself checked. I met a young lad on the train last week coming from Cardiff. And he said that next day he went and got checked. And unfortunately, I think he found something and it's being tested at the minute. So he sounded quite positive and, you know, but he said, I'd not have seen that, I wouldn't have checked and I wouldn't have gone to the doctor. I certainly wouldn't have gone to the doctors. I might have felt something, but just tried to ignore it.
Yeah.
So you really feel like you've made a difference. Mm. And there's not many jobs where the impact that can, you know, jobs that can have that impact. So I was very proud of that.
Well, fair play to you. I mean, amazing cause, and by all accounts, it's been tremendously well received.
Yeah.
Publicly. So, you know, well done for that. It's funny, Harry and I are starting to feel a little bit, I don't know what the word is, inferior. We're like with Callum in our last podcast with the world's sharpest jawline.
I need to join a gym.
Kelvin here with the world's biggest six pack of pectorals. I mean, look at the size of his arm.
If you've got size 14 feet, I think you'll be all right.
But actually, speaking
maybe you should have done the Full Monty.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'll wait for the call. Yeah.
I'm not sure the hat would be big enough to cover that up.
Wow, did not expect the podcast to go like that. But you just go back to the Full Monty. You did do it with some like big names, Jack from Love Island was at it, Joe Pasquale, Matt Evers as well, from Dancing on Ice. Is that something that's on your horizon? You've obviously done musicals. Dancing is in you, but also the fact I saw that you're quite good, you're quite up for sort of dancing with him as your partner or someone of the same sex.
He's just a lovely guy. Things like that. I've been amongst, you know, as an 8-year-old actor, thespian. That's all I've ever known. Most people in the creative industry, you know, a gay, or it's certainly a lot more fluid with the gender or with the sense of the sexuality. It's just, you know, when you're
playing cross genders as well. Yeah,
yeah, exactly, you know, yeah. When you're working with someone, you kind of fall in love with them, or you know, and the sex thing doesn't really. I don't know. I've never really had an issue with that. So yeah. To dance with a guy, and we'd be the first people doing it. That would be amazing. I think it was Matt that put the idea to me. And I was like, I don't know what he was expecting. Maybe for me just to fob it off, and I was like, that'd be really good. He was like, really? I was like, yeah, come on, let's practice now. So we were just.
is that confirmation that you're on it?
Oh no!
I thought we had the exclusive.
No, I don't know where that rumor's come from.
Genuinely, really? Yeah, just come out of nowhere.
I think there was a segment of me skating. We all went ice skating on the full Monty.
Right, okay.
And naturally someone like, oh, he'd be good on that. But no,
you're quite handy at skating, because I understand that you used to play a bit of inline hockey.
Yeah,
as
yeah.
did I.
Oh, right, okay.
I played for a team called the Beverly Bulldogs years ago.
Right.
We were quite good. We were quite handy. But you've obviously done that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've got that sort of balance and that perhaps a little bit of skating ability.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. You know, but what if you fall? That's the worry, isn't it?
Well,
it's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, it's funny for you, but it's not for me. Yeah. It's balls. Yeah, that's my worry, you know. But
of course, you've got to think about the racing as well.
Exactly.
If
you're
injured, that has a whole knock-on effect, doesn't
true.
It?
That's but, it.
Actor, well, racing driver, ice skater. What a life.
I could never ice skate. They don't make them big enough, sadly.
Oh, but, that's true.
Yeah, there was a time where I literally was able to ice skate and then no longer
You'd
able to.
You'd have to strap swords to your feet.
Yeah.
Listen, the final three, we've got three questions which we're going to throw at you, which we asked Callan in the last podcast, and we'll be asking all of our guests. The first, what's got you excited at the moment?
I sat filming on a feature film on Monday, so it's going to be my first ever film, so that's got me very excited. Set in 1945, just before the end of World War II. And I'm playing a British spy who's dropped over in occupied France to retrieve our prize asset, which is one of our top spies. So
brilliant.
So yeah, that was that kind of came out of the blue, and it's a British independent film, you know. But I'm sure it'll be out throughout a few cinemas and theatres and whatnot. I think 2020, something like that. So yeah, we start filming in Suffolk on Monday. So I'm doing that for a couple of weeks. So my next round is at Silverstone, and it could have been a deal breaker when they got in touch and they said, these are the filming dates. I was like, first thing I do is check the calendar, British GT, and it fell over the British, you know, the Silverstone 500. And I went back and said, I'm racing that Saturday and Sunday. I can't. Is it going to be an issue? And they said, well, yeah. You know, I was like, oh no, because if I had to choose, you know, acting is my main thing. That is what I am and what I want to do. You know, racing is just a bonus, and I've been able to kind of make it, not another career as such, but you know, it's like that, but acting is still absolutely the number one. Anyway, we managed to make it work. So after it, I'm just off to have my beard shaved completely off and left with a little mustache.
Very nice.
So, how do you feel about that? You happy with that, or is it
well, what's annoying is that the director sent me a picture of Brad Pitt from Inglourious, and I'm like, I'm not Brad Pitt. I don't look as good as that. So he, I don't know if he's got these amazing, you know, he thinks I'm going to look like him, but yeah, I don't know. Really,
is it the handlebars or just a little one?
It's a little bit. It's a very, someone described it to me quite well. It's like a camp mustache. It's like a very petite and quite thin. Yeah. So that's what I'm going for, I think.
I'm going to be sporting a new bit of facial hair.
So that's what I'm excited about in the minute. So filming starts on Monday, in Suffolk. So
nice.
Brilliant. If not racing, and I guess acting, what would you be doing?
If I could do anything in the world, I'd be a MotoGP rider. But what would I be doing? I'd have to say a singer, you know.
Yeah.
Justin Timberlake, Ed Sheeran, something like that. What a life, you know.
Yeah.
That would be the...
Is that your kind of go-to listening stuff, people like Ed Sheeran?
Yeah, anything really.
Well, you should really listen to Hits Radio.
Hits Radio, yes. Well, there you go. I think I do, actually.
Hey, there we go, then. Yeah, perfect. All the biggest hits.
Did your radio voice just come out quickly?
A little bit, yeah.
finally, last question. How much of your success is about luck and right place, right time, and how much do you put down to pure hard work?
Great question. I'd say 70-80% hard work, and the rest is luck.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, the rest, there's an element of luck there without shadow of a doubt. And it's not just a tiny, a friend of mine tells me that you make your own luck, you know, but I don't know, you know. there's a thing with luck, being in the right place at the right time. But I've seen the opportunity, I've embraced the opportunity to go out there. Like this podcast, for instance. So you guys have got in touch, I'm not getting paid for this. You know, it's not an inconvenience, but I'll come out of my time.
Yeah.
Because I see value in it, and not in a sense of that I can exploit you anyway, but there's value for you, there's value for me, there's, I can see the bigger picture. Yeah. So even though it's a cost for me initially, if you look at it like that,
yeah,
I'm willing to absorb that and see something bigger. Whereas a lot of people maybe wouldn't think, well, yeah, am I getting paid for it? No, I'm not doing it. What's And it's, so I think that's a missed opportunity. Now something might come of this. There's every chance nothing will come of it.
Well, you've got a lovely hat.
But the amount of times when I've done that, when I've gone to an event where it's the other end of the country, it's a charity do, whatever it might be, and I think, I don't know, I've got a good feeling, I'm going to go there. Not always looking for something good to come out of it, because it might just be a good thing too and a nice experience, but most of my great things, whether it's jobs or sponsors or opportunities like that, have always come out of those little things where I've put myself out there, you know. So my mate always tells me, you know, you can't win the raffle if you don't buy a ticket.
Yeah.
And it's that whole thing. So, yeah. But with that, there's also that element of luck as well. And, you know, I work hard. I'm very committed. And I think the biggest thing is to be resilient, you know, and that's one thing I've got more than anything else is, you know, don't be, you know, too upset when you get a no, because you're going to get a lot of no's. And I've had so many no's so far. I'll probably get some more today, tomorrow, the next day, and just carry on.
Yeah, great answer. Thank you.
Cheers,
well,
guys.
Kelvin.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Actor, racing driver, future ice skater. Who knows what's coming next? Film.
That's the beauty of it, isn't it? You never quite know what's happening.
Yeah. It's been great. Thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you, guys.
Take it easy. We'll see you soon.
See you next time. Thank you so much for listening to episode 2 of the Motormouth podcast, and special thanks to Kelvin and his team for giving up his time. We'll be back with another episode soon, but in the meantime, if you missed our first episode with racing driver and Fernando Alonso protege Callan O'Keefe, you can listen back to that now. Like, subscribe and review if you feel so inclined, and we'll see you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.